and welcome to the Open Era Podcast. My name is Devang Desai, and I'm joined, as always, by Mr. Simon Bushel Bush, reporting live from La Belle Provence. You've become Quebecois, is it true?
Oui, it's true. C'est ça, as you would say over here in Quebec. It's beautiful. I've never actually had the opportunity to be in Montreal. I've lived in Canada almost a decade now and never been to the most beautiful province, as they would say over here, in the whole country. It's a really nice city. I'm very, very impressed through the first 2.5 days of being here. So it's admittedly, it is nice and warm, and it's not covered in 10 feet of snow. So I've seen it quite a good time of the year. But in general, good province, good city.
Montreal, easy top five in terms of Canada, but you could probably put that top two. Definitely a place to visit if you are looking for a spot in Canada. That's not Toronto or Vancouver, because I think those are the go-tos. Simon, that's exciting. That's fun. More exciting, more fun, possibly, is that we have another guest. We keep it coming with the guests on Open Era. Let the folks know who's with us this week.
Yeah, sure thing. So we're delighted to have on Owen. You'll probably know him better as Tennis Nation on Twitter, serial tweetist, and The Racket. You can read all of his thoughts on the tennis store at racketblog.com. Owen, we are delighted to have you on, but I will lead this off. A tweet you put out 3 days ago, someone asked your most unpopular film-related opinion, and you said The Hobbit over Lord of the Rings. Can you please explain that to everyone?
Yeah. So this is actually, first of all, thank you for having me on. I actually don't listen to many tennis podcasts, but I've listened to a few episodes of Open Era and thought you guys did great work. So really happy to be here. And on that opinion, this is something I tell all my friends, and I don't think anyone has agreed with me yet. And so it could be the bias because I watched The Hobbit first. So those might just have more nostalgic connotations, but I think they're easier to follow. And I think the fight scenes in the CGI are better. And it's all about that for me, honestly. So,
woof, what an opinion. We'll leave it at that, perhaps.
Fair enough.
You might have quite a lot of people who disagree with you. Dev, it's been quite the week in tennis, hasn't it?
It has. I wish I had an opinion on this firestorm, but I'll stay out of it for the greater good. But we will get to the tennis Monday off the court. Some movement on the Alexander Zverev case. The ATP announced that their own internal investigation will move forward. Interestingly enough, I think the Zverev camp used this news to kind of signal that they're ready for this to happen, and that the facts will disclose that they are in the right and that Alexander Zverev is innocent, whereas I think a lot of people are curious about how this investigation will actually go forward and how they're going to do this. I've read a lot of good stuff this week. I'm sure you guys have been pouring through the various takes, but I'm curious, top line, Simon, what was your overall view of the news on Monday and what it means going forward?
I think top line's worse, confusion, because we've been asking for some movement on this for a while. And then when it came out, there was not a lot of details. And when the things that were chosen to be investigated, there was some, let's say, gray areas that I think a lot of people had questions about. So that side of things is a little difficult to sort of get your head around. By the way, you mentioned an investigation referred to by the ATP Tour as an independent safeguarding report, which I thought was an interesting turn of phrase, to say the least. And probably the second part of it, so confusion from the ATP side of it, but the second part is some of the quotes from Alexander Zverev himself this week as well, which when asked about it, he did not cover himself in glory, despite, I think, being better prepared going into a press conference by his camp than previously. But still, some of the quotes that came out were very, I would say, upsetting for some people who have been following this case for a while, of someone who still can't really reconcile what situation is faced with him and how he's perceived in this case as well. So I think those were the top line things that struck me, Dev.
Yeah, I would agree with those comments being upsetting. And I think, Owen, you hit on this on Twitter about basically Zverev using this moment to also use Andy Murray's words kind of and twist them into a bizarre sort of defense of himself. It's kind of par for the course. This has been the modus operandi in terms of their PR defense and Alexander Zverev's defense. And as he goes forward talking about how any other season like his would be commended of how great it is kind of in this light, which I thought was also bizarre. But I guess, Owen, if you wanted to expand on what you tweeted, because I thought it was poignant.
Yeah, I mean, I found his strategy kind of bizarre throughout this whole thing. I mean, first of all, when the original allegations came out, which were very detailed, he didn't respond in detail at all. He's just been making these blanket denials of everything, which don't make him look honest at all. And then I thought the Murray thing really just tried to divert the attention, because Murray is a popular figure in the sport. He's sort of this tennis champion for women's rights. And I think by sort of bringing his name up and trying to agree with him, Zverev is trying to put himself in that camp, which is completely bizarre because it's, I mean, he's been accused of domestic violence very credibly. So I don't know. I've not been a fan of how he's handled it.
It's definitely grimy, right? Like that is the move of a not trustworthy person, in my opinion, at least. I was reading what Matt at the Racket, his Substack, was talking about in terms of comparing the other sports. And now that there is this investigation being announced, there is some parallels we can perhaps draw to other sports and maybe the Big Four that we have in North America. But of course, we have unions there and we have contracted players who are definitely part of the league in a framework that is a lot more set than the ATP and the WTA. So I think we have this investigation announced. Bush, you called it correctly, safeguarding, which is just so filled with legalese that it makes my head hurt. But I wonder, going forward now, do we temper our expectations? Because I think what Matt was saying in his article was that it is unlikely that the ATP investigation is going to maybe render the verdict that we think is fair in terms of what we view as the correct way forward. What do you think?
Certainly seems that way, doesn't it? A tempering of expectations, I think, is probably acceptable here, because can anyone explain why the Laver Cup is not included here? I mean, you mentioned legalese and you mentioned like people getting lost in the weeds.
That's so ridiculous to me, because the ATP is trying to count these Laver Cup matches under their head-to-heads, yet they're not accepting it under their umbrella of responsibility. And the Laver Cup, the events that happened at the Laver Cup are a big, big part of this. So it's not encouraging at all.
No, I mean, it's disgraceful if we call it what it actually is, right? If we want to hit on it more pertinently here. I think the quotes from Calvelli himself were interesting. They seemed like, that's ATP CEO, sorry, just for everyone out there. It seemed like very broad sort of catch-all language. And I say this as, you know, someone who works in comms for a long time. I'm going to quote him. As an organization, we recognize the need to be doing more to ensure everyone involved in professional tennis feels safe and protected. The recommendations of the safeguarding report will help us approach this in a robust way. We are committed to making meaningful steps and know this won't be an overnight process. What does meaningful steps mean here? I mean, that's the one phrase that steps out to me. What does that actually mean?
There's a hope in maybe this is foolish optimism, but because there is such little history here in terms of what the ATP has done or what judgments they've rendered, it is a time for them to potentially do something that these organizations before them have kind of started and not done well. I don't think we look at the NFL or the NBA or MLB as paragons of virtue when it comes to handling incidents like this, but there's a lot of cases like these that they can use to maybe facilitate some positive things going forward. So maybe that's pie in the sky thinking, but the way he was talking, Bush, that kind of like overarching, you can call it mumbo jumbo and like not really sticking to anything, platitudes.
Well, call it
but,
nothing.
Right. But it does open us up to something perhaps that's beyond just this single case as well, right? Where there's other players as well that could be, this could be applied to Bashiashvili's case as well, right?
Theoretically, yes. Theoretically, that's possible. I think you're perhaps reading, you're being a little too charitable in terms of,
I think
of,
I am,
when,
yeah.
of how this might play out. Just a reminder to everyone, like especially when in context of Calvetti's quotes and the fact that we're still trying to learn, we're still trying to, you know, Ray Rice, that incident that I think most of it was a sparking point for a lot of people, that was in 2014, right? We've been... Yeah. dealing with this as an entity for a very long time in professional sports. This is not a new incident. Like, and by the way, me implying that, you know, domestic violence in professional sports started in 2014, I'm aware of that, is not true. But perhaps this is the most high profile case that I think was a spark plug for a lot of these other situations and a lot of these implementations of policies. So that was 8 years ago. The fact that no one in this sport has had the self-reflection to look at themselves and think that we should probably do something in that stead in the meantime is quite worrying.
It is. It's on the heels as well. Nick Kyrgios was in a quarantine back home with his girlfriend. They had returned to Australia. They had now been separated in their quarantine after an incident. This is after she posted on Instagram some of Nick's behaviors that also fall on the lines of abuse and are awful. And it goes to this general culture change or culture reset that the ATP needs. I feel like we talk about the WTA a lot on this show, and it's not only because I think the tennis is fantastic. I think overall it feels a lot better to talk about the WTA a lot of the time, Owen. I don't know, how do you feel about this?
I mean, I completely agree. I mean, you have the Zverev thing, Basilashvili, now Kyrgios has come up in these screenshots that his girlfriend posted. I think her name's pronounced Kiara. They're completely horrifying, and it is absolutely abuse, and there's nothing in place that can deal with this. And then there was the debacle with ATP players not following COVID guidelines. The WTA was much more consistently good with that. And yeah, it's just really upsetting because it seems like there are no consequences at all. Like, you have these verified Twitter accounts actively trying to protect Zverev, basically, like the Laver Cup blocking everyone who tweeted the Slate article. Like, it didn't matter what they were saying. Like, they weren't saying, you know, screw you, Laver Cup. They were saying, like, please read this article, and then they got blocked. And again, it's a verified account. So it's, yeah, I completely agree that the WTA is a more optimistic thing to look at.
On that note, and we recommend listening to No Challenges Remaining, they had Mary Carrillo talking about that Laver Cup stuff, as well as these latest developments. Bush, I know you wanted to touch on that.
I did. I think it's a good interview. And I think everyone on this podcast has given a lot of praise to Ben Rothenberg for his work on this story, because it's been very diligent. I recommend everyone to go and listen to that episode. I would like to touch on Zverev's quotes really quickly, because I think the one that's really sticking out like a sore thumb is, quote, "To be honest, it's very difficult in my situation because a lot of the time the man is not really believed." I mean, this is not good. Someone needs
it's
to tell
true
this dude to
well.
Shut up.
It's that's it's not just, true as well.
It's just objectively not true. That's the yeah. Right. It's
yeah,
not
it's,
a good scenario.
It's uneducated. You can look at any number of years of history to show that is not true. He's speaking
the guy,
from a personal perspective.
Guys, the guy is talking about that in one case, and then he's talking about how great his season has been. Like, a second later, I'm like, what are you doing? What is this?
I mean, if you think about it, he is under these very, very serious allegations. Like, there's a very good argument that he should be, like, in jail for this. And he's getting asked one question, and he says, like, the man is not believed. It's like, look at his position. He's basically getting nothing for this right now. And he's acting all put upon, which is just even more upsetting.
Well, it's the total extension of that as well, right? Like, in that one quote, you have an example of how someone hasn't faced the repercussions of their actions. Like, saying that effectively, you know, these are credible accusations that have happened, and the net result is I have gone on to win the Olympics and 2 Masters Series and 4 tournaments. Like, so that's not consequences.
Exactly.
That is someone just going on and actually succeeding in their life whilst a person has suffered at the hands of this person.
Yeah, and this is a much smaller thing, but this is not one of the greatest seasons a young guy has had in the last 10 years.
Yeah, seriously.
I mean, he is not there yet. He needs to be more humble.
Olympic gold. I know a lot of people have Olympic gold. Yeah, man. I know it used to be cool. I'm being a little facetious there, but we will see where this goes.
But yeah,
exactly. I don't think we expect a resolution soon, and we'll be left in this position. We are in this position where Zverev will continue to play in the big tournaments, like at Indian Wells and like in Paris-Bercy and like at the ATP Finals. So I think this story will remain in the news, and rightfully so. But this investigation announcement also means that I think more people will read about it, which again is what we've been recommending. You read the article, you read the Slate article, you read the follow-ups, you make your own judgment. But I think we're hopeful that there are some positive developments in this space. I'll do a bit of a quick turn to Indian Wells, Bush, and the young brigade that took our hearts at the U.S. Open. Emma Raducanu has lost already at the U.S. Open, but she got the feature treatment in the New York Times, and she was talking about something I think we talked about a bit in the last couple of weeks, this quote-unquote one-hit wonder syndrome, and maybe hastily giving it to people too quickly.
No kidding. This is a Christo Cleary article, and pretty interesting stuff, actually, for an article that I think was quite heavily PR'd from the sounds of things and the way that this is written. I thought there was actually quite a lot of good stuff in there from what Raducanu said, because it sort of extended to where she is at post-US Open. And the quote from Andreescu is really good, basically advising that, you know, try and be grateful, enjoy the success you're having, because it can be gone very, very quickly. And don't we know how challenging of a season it's been for Bianca Andreescu? I thought that the second part of it was really fascinating, though, as well, in terms of she was asked about her sort of involvement in tennis and her voice and all these sort of things, because she is, you know, 18 years old. She is being compared to her peers with the likes of Naomi Osaka and Coco Gauff, specifically around issues around social justice and political activism, especially because obviously she comes from an immigrant background. And I think she dodged the question quite interestingly in terms of how she wants to position herself. And I thought that was, at first I sort of, you know, let it go from my mind, but I sort of chatted with my partner about this, and we were chatting about exactly what is the responsibility of a young athlete when it comes to their sort of position of sort of privilege and when their star has been so elevated, especially one who is being pushed so heavily by IMG and by Max Eisenberg into the spotlight in regards to sponsorship and regards to all the money that's coming along with that. And I think rightfully so in a lot of ways that she has achieved amazing things. But to sort of turn around and say that she doesn't quite have an opinion on social justice issues, on political activism, I thought was kind of telling, because on the one hand, it's clearly good PR. On the second hand, like, what is an expectation of someone who is so young? And thirdly, right, it kind of just goes to show you, right, that we're so lucky to have someone like Naomi Osaka and Coco Gauff in the sport that actually do take the risks to speak about these issues when they're very, very difficult to talk about. And I'm aware of the opposite side of that. Like, we're not asking someone like Carlos Alcaraz to talk on Catalonian independence, for example. We're not talking to Yannick Sinner about the five-star movement in Italy. So it's kind of an interesting situation to think about, of what the expectations are for a young player like this.
And that's not to say she won't, right? Like, because she is only 18, there's time, I think. So I think our expectations for her growth as a tennis player should also be maybe kept in check with her expectations for her as a person. But I see, it pains me to say it a bit as well, but it's a bit of the Fed kind of positioning as well, right? Where you're wearing all of these hats and you are presented as this person to so many different people as the face of something. Kind of have to be safe. Pains me to say it.
Yeah. I mean, I think for celebrities, in a way, your responsibility kind of grows in proportion to the growth of your platform. And Raducanu is in a tough position because she's just won the US Open, and her Instagram and social media profiles have multiplied like 20 times in size over the course of a week. And she's 18. So it's tough to suddenly deal with like no one looking to her, and now everyone is looking to her. And so I think, I hope eventually she does decide to speak out on social justice, because I think that's something every athlete should do, and that would be great. But yeah, I think right now everyone loves her. And it totally is the Fed thing, where when everyone loves you, you don't want to say anything that's going to get one of those corporations or groups to start disliking you. So I completely understand. Media is tough.
You're only a few steps away from a John Cena apology in Mandarin or Cantonese. I can't remember what language it was in, but we've seen it. We've seen it, folks. Okay, that was the headlines. When we come back, the tennis part, Kim Clijsters, Bianca, big W, sad news for Vasek. The courts being slow as hell. We chat about all that coming up next on Open Era. Welcome back to the Open Era podcast. Yes, it's time for the real tennis part of the show. TM still trying to get that trademarked, real tennis, getting it off the ground. We got fake tennis, but we love real tennis. That being said, is Indian Wells real tennis, gentlemen? I ask this because it is one of those tournaments where I think you could fairly say it doesn't produce the greatest tennis. Some of the slowest courts we'll see. Andre Rublev, quote, these conditions at night in Indian Wells are super, super, super extremely slow. It's hard to hit a winner. He said super three times there. I ask, is this still the Indian Wells we know and love, Simon?
I think it's a bit harsh to call it a tournament that no one cares about, or whatever your phrasing was, in terms of it's produced some pretty good matches over the year. I think it's undoubtedly true that it's slower this year, and also it's in a time period where does anyone really care post the last major of the year? We are in that second half of the NBA syndrome, second half of the NHL, where you're getting a lot of like soft wins and a bunch of soft ranking points. But I think it feels like we'll get a better idea of how much this tournament means when we get to the business end of it, when we get to quarterfinals, semifinals, and finals, to see who's actually there and see how much fight is left in some of these players. So, I mean, it's called the fifth major for a reason, for goodness sake. Like, it does still hold prestige to a certain extreme. And the fact that it's being played at all goes to show you how much it's valued by the ATP. The fact that they found a spot in the calendar for it at the back end of the year in October, when it could have easily just been cancelled for the second straight year. So I must admit, I have tried to watch as much as I can whilst being in Montreal, watching on bars here, seeing as for some reason tennis is being shown all around Montreal. But it is kind of curious that we find ourselves in this position and we're asking the question about whether or not this actually matters.
Yeah, I agree. I think sort of the position in the calendar is hurting it, because I think after the US Open, there's a great argument that nothing matters much. I mean, the World's Tour Finals, which is supposed to be the fifth biggest event on the ATP, has been called a glorified exhibition. And I can guarantee that that would not happen if it happened like between the French Open and Wimbledon. And so I think after the US Open, there is a tendency to sort of tune out a little bit and get some tennis burnout. But I mean, it's a lot of points. It's good fields. And as for the court speed, I think this is a really interesting question about slow, hard courts. And I think the quality of the players is also very relevant to this question, because I remember the 2012 Australian Open was some of the slowest courts. Super, super slow. Like, there was a rally between Murray and Nishikori, and it just took forever. And Murray won with like a kind of central slice winner, because it had been going for so long and Nishikori had no legs left. But if you look at like the top four in the ATP side, that was the big four, and they played both semis in the final were ridiculous quality, like off the charts. But you need players who are able to rally and be patient and have really consistent offense. If you have players who are not that consistent on a really slow court, you're going to get some ugly matches. So I think I don't mind it, but it sort of puts more responsibility on the players to play really well if it's going to be a good tournament.
Not to besmirch Philip Kohlschreiber and Taro Daniel, but they're not exactly the guys who could execute that high caliber rally.
Precisely, yeah.
Shot making. I think that's a great point. That's the caliber of the player. I watched a man,
Botik van de Zandschulp,
lose to Giron, but like that match as well, where these guys are hitting relatively like well and like powering through the ball, bit of a slog. And I think that was a sign of things to come. That being said, we've had some interesting results. Speaking of defending points, Bianca Andreescu is the defending champion here, which I think is wild on just about 1,000 levels. But she's a 16th seed here, live ranking. I believe she's in the 20s now. She'll be 22. She needed a win bad. And I honestly did not see it coming against Alison Risky, who's someone who is very consistent, and I think game-wise, you have to like Bianca's chances. But it still took her three sets. She's got Annette Kontaveit next. Just for that one win, though, Simon, very positive.
Definitely positive. She served like trash, though. 58% first serve in. Like, she did not have a good serving performance, but I think just did enough. You see, it's so frustrating, isn't it? I think for all of us who are Andreescu fans, it's so frustrating to watch a player that you know has another level. They just had, and you just don't see it on a regular basis. And whether that's mental, whether that's physical, whether it's a combination of both, or honestly, whether or not it's just someone who did way too much at an early stage and the rest of the tour didn't have a good read on the game, didn't have a good read of the patterns of what she likes to go to. And that's kind of caught up with her as well. All of these things have kind of played into an incredibly difficult 2 years. But you mentioned that she needed a win. By goodness, this will help, but she's got to go further here. She has so many points to defend that she has to keep putting these together.
I think Andreescu has Nishikori syndrome, where she cannot close a match in straight sets. And I have to believe it's mental, because the game is so good. Like, I think this match against Risk is a match that she should have won, like, 6-4, 6-4, or 6-4, 6-3. I think she had match points in the second set and lost it, and then had to play the third. And she won that 6-2, but we see this happen a lot, where she just gets dragged into three-setter after three-setter. And her body holds up well. Like, she has the endurance, but when you play so many of them, you will get injured, and you will get tired, and you will gas out eventually. And, like, being able to, you know, miss match points and lose a set and come back and win the match, like, that is a champion mindset. But if you have to do that every round, you're not going to be able to get to the rounds that matter. And so I think what she needs to figure out is just win matches quickly.
The Triyanka nickname is banter and hilarious, but also sad. It is not good.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. Like, that's what makes it funny.
Yeah, exactly. If there was going to be a time, though, for a rejuvenation period or to re-get it, to get back on the saddle, Kontaveit, perhaps Pliskova, if she wins that, I might be dreaming, but that would be wonderful. Early on, we had Kim Clijsters go out in the first round. Simon, I know you watched that intently. Great to see her back on the tour. I think that match was, like, the first set was what I thought the whole match was going to be, but the second set, I think, was maybe what Kim Clijsters could hope to bottle for a bit of a run here. I know she's a massive competitor, but as the match played out, I saw over three sets. I wonder, what is the end game here? What are we playing towards? Like, is she content with being back on tour and not winning?
Certainly sounded like that was the case from the quotes post-match, didn't it? Like, she seemed pretty content on keep giving this a go. Really, I think the thing that she needs to concentrate on is just hanging in matches, right? Like, she's still at a point where if she enjoys playing, who are we to tell her not to be out there, right? But I think the quote that stood out for me when she was talking about it was basically saying that this was never going to be a smooth ride. And I think that's true. Like, I think no one expected her to come straight back onto the tour and just demolish players. She's already done that once, right, in her career. It's not going to happen twice. Oh, wait, maybe it did. Maybe it's not going to happen three times. Let's go with that instead. She's 38. It's going to be unlikely that's going to happen. If she can return to anywhere near, if she can be a top 100 player, that should be considered a really good achievement at this stage. And who knows what reason that she is playing. That's basically down to her at this point.
I agree with that. I mean, I think she's not going to be able to do that slidey, Gumby-like defense that she had in, like, 2009, 2011. You have to play differently, and I totally agree with what you said. If she's enjoying it, then in a way it really doesn't matter how she does, and I hope she just gets what she wants out of this last comeback. Or who knows, could be another 10 years comeback at 48, and then, yeah.
In her defense as well, like, Sinakova, an ultimate baseline rally. Her match against Kerber, some insane rallies that went deep as well. Like, she had a tough opener as a wild card. I get some Murray vibes in the sense that perhaps, again, this will be a bit of a process, right? And nothing will be quick, but for the love of the game, you have to respect that. Simona Halep looks great as well, folks. I think that is a welcome sign after a bit of an absence. Anything else that stood out to you folks on the WTA side before we go to ATP?
I thought Simone Halep's going to win this tournament. That was, I don't know why. You know, when you get that feeling going into a tournament, you're like, I just think she's got that here. I'm not basing that on anything, given that it's been a pretty rough year on the back that she, you know, has been away for a little while. But I certainly got that sense. I just wanted to make a point really quickly. So Raducanu, Andreescu, Swiatek, three players who hit the piss out of the ball, stand close to the baseline, and who won majors very early in their career. So there's a lot of parallels that could be drawn between them. I think the one thing that really stood out to me in those three, and it's going to be really interesting how Raducanu goes, just given how early she lost here and the sort of years that those other two have had since they won majors, is winning so early, there's an element of you don't have players looking at your tendencies, and you don't have players who know how to game manage to you and play against your strengths, especially when you're just coming out and blitzing the ball how those three did. It's very difficult to, like, start the digging in process as an opponent to figure out, okay, she hits the ball here. If you lob back onto this side, she's going to try and put a ball into this area. And, you know, you can slow things down. When they're coming out and just like blitzing you and absolutely destroying you, it's going to be really difficult to do that. So I'm genuinely curious, because that was the point that I wanted to make on the Raducanu stuff, is that I've seen a lot of things written this week. And there was the article that came out from the Telegraph, which basically said that she was without, you know, coaches and people actually in her box, like, which doesn't seem good, like, especially when you don't have Gentle Andrew around. Gentle Andrew, who for some reason Pog seems to love. he's gonna message me about that. Yeah, exactly. I think it's a little more worrying, and I don't want to sound the alarm after someone's just won a US Open and, you know, lost first match back, but players do read. Players do read and react to you, and they do figure you out pretty quickly. There's nothing ever is kept secret in tennis.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think another thing with Raducanu especially, but Swiatek as well, is they were so dominant when they won their majors. Like, they haven't had to do so many things that happen in a tennis match. Like, they don't know what it's like to serve to stay in a match. Andreescu's has this because she's had to fight in so many close matches, but Raducanu doesn't know what it's like to, you know, fight from a set down or any of these other things because she's been so dominant. And so even though, like, she now has the experience of winning a major, winning 10 matches in a row because she went through qualifying, all these other experiences are really lacking. And so I think that on top of players, like, I mean, players are coming for her now. Like, she's a threat. And so everyone wants to take her down. I think that's going to be a tough combination to deal with. And not saying she's incapable of it at all, but it'll be interesting to track how she goes from here because so many different circumstances now.
Leila Fernandez looked good against Elise Cornet. Speaking of US Open stars, Pavlyuchenkova next, which would be another great test on these slow courts. But speaking of youngsters showing up to prove it again, Leila Fernandez, keenly watched by Canadian observers, at least on the men's side. Speaking of Canadians, looks like Vasek's back, acted up again against Chapo on Saturday night, which is very disappointing, but we hope he will do well to recover from that. I think the ATP side, frankly, gentlemen, I am again a bit going through the motions here. We are waiting to see some cool stuff on Sunday as you record. I think we're all excited for Alcaraz Murray, which should be, yes, a death slog on these courts. My God, Andy Murray should file for some sort of defense clause, because I feel like that could be murder on his legs. But I wanted to shout out that match. I wanted to shout out Brooksby Zverev, which I think could be interesting as well. Brooksby, we remember from the US Open. But Danny Medvedev, I watched the Mackie McDonald match in full. Again, I think to Owen's point, on a slow court, you get to marvel a bit and some of the shit Danny Medvedev does. But there was one point, the octopus point, where I can't remember exactly when it was in the match, but basically returning every ball that Mackie McDonald put in play. And I was like, yeah, that's a US Open winner. And it felt good to call him that. I'm like, this guy really deserved it. And it was good for him to kind of show out on the Indian Wells show court, I thought.
The stuff he's doing is blowing my mind. Like, I said on Twitter, I think when players get engaged in these 40-shot rallies with him, I think they just have to bail out after they hit, like, five shots. Yeah. Because even if you win, it's going to take out your legs and he's going to be fine. And yeah, if you don't have, like, a team forehand or a Nadal forehand, or if you don't have a perfect game like Djokovic, on a hard court, there's just really not a lot you can do. He's going to grind you down. It's going to be miserable. He'll find your weakness. And yeah, I mean, players who are significantly worse than him, like McDonald, no disrespect intended, he played a pretty good match, and he did not have a break point. He lost the second set 6-1. Like, it was a demolition, and he didn't really do anything wrong. So yeah, I think everyone would hate to play Medvedev right now.
I saw this great tweet that got put out. Medvedev is at the point where he shouldn't lose to anyone on a hard court except maybe an in-form Novak Djokovic. Quite the ascent he's made. That tweet was made by you, Owen, and I agree with you. I thought it was absolutely on point. So
I was waiting for
credit.
A huge bomb. I was
Thank
waiting
you.
For a huge. I was like, you know what? And that tweet was garbage.
I was wondering if that would come up. And I think the one exception to that is an informed Dominic team. I think if Medvedev loses to him, that's also fine, because the last time Medvedev played really well on a hard court and lost, I think was the US Open semifinals last year, when Team actually beat him in straight sets, which was amazing. Because Team can sort of out-defend Medvedev sometimes and put the pressure on him to do the attacking. And since Medvedev doesn't have that bazooka forehand, it's a position he's less accustomed to being in. But I'm not sure if that Team is going to return to the tour. I hope he does. I think he's left a giant hole in his absence. But yeah.
Not really sure, right? Does he get a bionic wrist, come back with that? Is it possible that it is way more severe than we know of? But that's a big hope, because I think his addition and the hole that you mentioned is it's recognizable, especially with time happening and the big three moving on, because that's happening, right? So we can look smart tomorrow, and this is recorded, so by the time our listeners listen to this, the smash will have already happened. What do you think will happen in Alcaraz Murray, Simon?
I don't know. I know it's going to go long. I don't know.
It's actually, I can't wait.
The reason that I don't know is because I think it's really evenly matched. And we don't really know how Carlos Alcaraz is going to deal with an incredibly wily veteran. Someone who really, you know, you talk about in the previous things we were talking about with regards to players figuring out weaknesses and testing them repeatedly over and over again. Andy Murray will do that to Carlos Alcaraz, probably for 3 straight hours, and he'll make him torment for that time. I don't know. I think if I was going to take a stab at this one, I would have the wily veteran getting one over on the young kid here. But having said that, you can also envision a scenario where Alcaraz doesn't miss for 2 hours and Andy Murray looks old as well. So it's quite an interesting battle.
Absolutely, yeah. Devang, do you want to give your prediction first?
I do, because I want to sound kind of less bold in saying that I think with Murray knowing that the finish line is a lot more in sight than if it would be at a major. And because it's 3 sets, I like his chances a bit better because he can redline a bit more against the young buck. I am going to pick Murray as well. Shocker.
Okay. Yeah, I needed some more time to think there. So I'm actually gonna push back and say Alcaraz wins this one. I think if he plays like he did against Tsitsipas at the US Open, I think he's a crisper hitter of the ball. And I think that'll help him in the slow conditions. And I see Murray doing most of the running.
And I think to back you, I think the crowd will be better than it has been. I think this is gonna be a signature match early on. A lot of people there. I think Carlos likes that. He doesn't shy away from it. So I can see it. I can see it.
Yeah, I think redlining Murray would have a great chance, but I just don't think redlining is Murray's style, and I don't think it's ever been his style. So I just can't bank on that Murray showing up.
Wanted to shout out Francis Tiafoe. Massive win over Seb Korda. That's a big one. Anything else, guys, ATP-wise? I know it's early, but we should make our picks. I know you picked Halep, Bush on the WTA side, but let's hear picks on both sides. If you want to back Halep with someone on the men, Simon, who are you picking?
Danny Medvedev. Not a particularly difficult one to pick.
Owen?
Yeah, I'm going to go Medvedev as well. And on the WTA side, this is tough. I haven't really looked at the way either draw is arranged. And so the ATP, I'll pick Medvedev regardless of that because I don't think it matters much. But the WTA makes things tough. I think I kind of want to pick Fernandez, honestly. I mean, she did really well in her first rounder. She's still got a ton of momentum. So I'll say Fernandez 1A, Swiatek 1B.
Fernandez in the bottom half, it's doable. It's definitely doable. I think Svitolina's there, who I'm not threatened by in the least. Swiatek, which would be an amazing quarterfinal if that were to happen. I like the Fernandez pick. I'm going to go with Annette Kontaveit. This is a shocking pick, but I'm backing her after a very strong fall and a title win 2 weeks ago, I believe. So I'm going to back her to beat Bianca as well. So by the time this is released, I could look really stupid with all of my picks being made. On the men's side, to also shock you guys, because I think Danny Medvedev would win this, but predicting Opelka giving him a problem in the fourth round, I'm going to say that Stefanos Tsitsipas returns to the winner's circle in Indian Wells as my final bold pick. You heard it first.
I don't think that's a bad pick. It's slow, so he'll be able to actually return
serve. My thinking his problematic return of serve that deserves a million word treatise will be less of a problem on the slow courts. Also, Sid or Milman, Simon, you have to choose between your sons.
Oh, I know. Obviously, Taking Yannick Sinner. How could I not? Future world number one, Yannick Sinner.
All right, that's Indian Wells. We'll wrap up what happens next week. Before we go, though, we return, as always, with our parting shots. Welcome back to the Open Era Podcast. It's that time again. Parting shots. Simon, I'm going to hit you with one of my biggest conspiracy theories of all time. And it's tennis related. I'm glad Owen is here to hear it. But I think the Andy Murray wedding ring incident was a psyop. I don't know if it actually happened. I don't know if he actually lost the ring. I don't know if it was ever out of his knowledge of being lost. That is my claim.
Just trying to get on tennis TV.
Yeah, I think this is some clever content marketing, the stuff we love. You know, this is 101 stuff. But I just don't, something about the ring returning that quickly. I don't know. I was left skeptical.
Oh goodness me! You think you think somewhere on a whiteboard, someone in a PR company's got up? What if Andy loses his wedding ring? And
what ensues?
Yeah, sure. Right? Why not? I'll go with that. Seems reasonable.
I think my favorite take on it, I'm not sure, do either of you follow Duncan Murray on Twitter, the other Murray brother?
Yeah, so
he tweeted out, like, you know, the other day I found a pair of smelly shoes under a car. Like, I figured I could take them because I didn't know whose they were. Best of all, there was a shiny ring attached that seems to fit me. And this was great because I've never been that lucky in life. And so I thought that was hilarious. But yeah, glad Andy got the ring back, and I hope it wasn't a corporate scam.
As always, I hope it wasn't a corporate scam is the underlying message for everything, but it was, yeah. It was hilarious. It was good. We've all been there trying our shoes out under a car, as one does, but you had this in here, Simon, so I'll let you close the book on this.
No, I just thought it was an interesting story. Like, it happens every so often that you actually have something fun happen and unexpectedly nice happening.
I should let you lead off instead of beginning with my extremely cynical take of what happened, but
that's just in the parting shot. Can I go off menu? Can I go a la carte? Because I want to throw one at you both, because this, I wouldn't have brought this up unless Jenson Brooksby was playing against Alexander Zverev in Indian Wells on this court. Is this actually good for tennis? This, not necessarily this match, like you lose all, you can put all the narratives aside. These two are going to play for 4 hours. I mean, what are they going to play? Three sets. It's going to be long. It is going to be grueling. It is not going to be particularly interesting. There's not going to be a whole lot of winners in this match. Is this actually interesting? Because I had this question and Devang had to listen to my meltdown following Brooksby versus Novak Djokovic at the US Open. And I think putting everything aside,
I just want to say, Simon, one of the five people I've talked to in my life who didn't like that match, who hated it. Beyond belief.
I'm surprised to hear that. I thought it was great.
I thought the narrative was great. I thought, like, the storylines that were in it were really good. I thought tennis-wise, it was boring as paint. Goodness me. Like, it was
that 3-1
so
game
dull.
In the second set? You didn't like that?
Oh, okay, that was good. Fine, I'll give you that one. But in general, I just don't enjoy 25-shot rallies. I just don't, when no one's doing anything. They're just moving the ball down the middle of the court. Like, you're just aiming for big targets, not going for lines, just effectively waiting for mistakes from your opponent. And I think, like, it's no disrespect to Jenson Brooksby, because I think, you know, someone who strikes a ball as cleanly on a wing, on a backhand wing, maybe not on his forehand wing. If I was a fan outside of the sport and someone said the world number, the three seed in this tournament is playing against an up-and-coming US player, I would just have no interest in watching this match, just at all. It's just, to me, it's incredibly boring. Is that, so my question is about, is that actually a fair statement, or is it, you know, different strokes for different folks when it comes to tennis styles?
I don't think you can remove the narrative from this one, which makes it good viewing, if that makes sense. Because I think I back your general, your thesis on, like, the ethos of tennis, and if someone should take a shot to go backhand down the line or do something a bit interesting, I'm down with that. But I think it's impossible to remove the other stuff with Brooksby as well, being what he did in New York. So though I understand what you're saying, I think this match might be beyond that Owen, is that fair?
Yeah, Simon, I think your take is definitely fair. I'm not sure I agree. I am kind of a sucker for matches where both players get tired. I love watching attrition and endurance come into play in a match. I mean, I touched on 2012 Australian Open earlier, that final with Djokovic and Nadal. Some of those rallies were not interesting, but I loved it because they were so exhausting. And I love seeing players figure out what to do when they have to deal with their physical limits. And so I think one rally on its own, pushing down the middle for 25 shots, definitely not interesting. But I think if you have games upon games of that, and eventually players have to change the way they're playing because their legs are screaming, I find that fascinating.
I think it's the beautiful part about the sport that we love, right? Isn't it? Of where these things on the Venn diagram sit. Like, because you can't remove the physical side of the sport. Like, you can't remove like the grueling endurance part of it. And it's about where on that, you know, that line you sit in terms of what's dominant in the sport at the time. Now you would say much more, it's more about being incredibly fit, being incredibly strong, mentally strong, and less to do in general with being a big shot maker who manages to hit through a court. I think that's fair. It has nuance to it, that take, so I don't take it as a whole. But in general, my point that I always try to make on this is I like Hicham El-Gurus as much as the next person. I don't enjoy watching the marathon. I enjoy watching Usain Bolt on 100 meters. That's kind of my perspective on tennis in general as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's completely fair. Like, I agree, if players are just pushing the ball down the middle, it's not interesting. What makes a long rally fun is, you know, the angles and the dynamics, and, you know, one player makes a crazy get and they reset the point and then they keep going. If it's all down the middle, then yeah, it's not that fun.
I'll stop talking now. I could go on about this for a long time about, you know, I mean, this is the art of most professionalization in sport, isn't it? The same is true in the NBA. Like, no one likes drive and kick, but, you know, it's become a staple in the NBA. You remove bad shots. The same thing is true in tennis. Like, you remove big, you know, shots where you're trying to go for lines are not high percentage shots. So why would you coach someone who is 14, 15 years old to go for those shots? You're better to coach someone to go for bigger targets and bigger areas and hit with more spin. And the net result of that is you have a dude who is world number one, who's won 20 majors, who will win another 10, who is incredibly fit, incredibly flexible, mentally strong, although that's questionable sometimes, and who hits with the biggest targets and is hugely brilliant on defense and returning. That is the hallmark of a really good champion at the moment. And I think that's an interesting question of whether that's actually good for the sport or not.
I think part of that is subjective as to what styles mm-hmm. you like.
Yep.
And I mean, I do think that is how things will be. Like, you can see Medvedev following that blueprint already. Like, basically have no weaknesses, make every ball, and make it impossible for the opponent to hit through you. And now Medvedev's even added a huge serve to that. So yeah, I do wonder, but I think if players can do that at an elite enough level, I think it's spellbinding to watch. But I do think the key is that elite level. Like, I think Brooksby, I really questioned what he did against Djokovic at the US Open, because yeah, he made it attritional, but he wasn't fit enough. He had no chance to win that match because he gassed out in the middle of the second set. Like, an hour had gone by, and that first set was a 6-1. So it's like, I get it. He took some steps, but he was a million miles away from winning that match. I don't think it was smart. It was amazing to watch, but yeah, I think for it to truly work and for it truly to be great to watch, you have to do it really, really well, like Djokovic does.
What you're saying is, Owen, it was a secret operation by the USTA. All Brooksby to do was to take out Djokovic and make sure that he couldn't win the tournament. Take his legs
right. out. that run to the final.
Yeah. So piggyback on the Medvedev point for my parting shot, I want to shout out that Bill Simon's Riley Opelka interview in Inside Tennis. It's really good. Opelka talks about a lot of stuff, but he does say the Russians are coming when it comes to whether or not Americans can get back into the top 10. He's like, nah, man, the Russians are coming. He's talking about Danny Medvedev.
I loved what he said about Laver Cup. They were like, Bill Simon was like, can you turn it around? And he's like, no, there's no way. Like, they're too good. And I was like, I loved that he said that because it's true. Like, why would you sugarcoat it and tell a lie? So that was refreshing.
The whole thing's good. And it's not to say I agree with everything, but I think he is one of those cats who's telling it like it is. And for the most part, I do agree with most stuff. So Riley Opelka, we stand once again.
Let's go to some quick fire ones. Barbara Krejcikova was interviewed in WTATennis.com in regards to her attitude change of why she had such a good 2021. This article is fascinating for some small reasons. The fact that Barbara Krejcikova basically had a tough loss and decided, you know what, I'm just going to be happy. That's basically what the article says. And the net result of that is she had one of the best years on tour. It's an interesting read. I think she's leaving out a few details in regards to how she managed to do this, but I thought that was a good wrinkle.
Yeah, I agree. Just to jump in really quickly, I'm not sure if either of you have read Nadal's autobiography, but early in his career, he wrote about this time where he had like a fun weekend, but it meant he couldn't properly train for a tournament. And then he lost, and he was telling his dad, like, you know, this is horrible. And his dad goes, oh, come on, it's not that bad. You had a fun weekend. And Nadal goes, no, you don't understand. I never want to feel this way again. And Krejcikova basically said the same thing. So I did notice that parallel. Jeez, and yes. I think the desire to avoid pain like that is a great motivator. I mean, losing sucks.
Yeah, it's true.
So, yeah, I think it does make some sense.
I wanted to pick her to win Indian Wells, by the way, but I cowered it out. I'll probably feel shame if she does win, but that's fantastic. And I can vividly picture Rafa talking to his dad and his dad being like, what are you talking about? Because his dad does seem super chill in the box at all times. I love that, man.
So Feliciano Lopez broke the record for most Masters played. 139th tournament. Whose record did he break, Devang?
Oh, no.
Come on, this one's easy. By the standards of what I've given you in the past, this one's quite straightforward.
I know, but that makes it worse. Is the player still active is my only hint I'll ask for.
Barely.
Okay, Fed. It's Fed.
It is Roger Federer.
Yeah. Fed, yeah.
I actually looked at this in the doc and thought Federer, and then I was like, no, he skipped so many Masters early in his career, it can't be him. So I was going to guess Karlovic.
Same. Evo, Dr. Evo. What do you know?
Okay, moving on quickly. The Billie Jean Cup final, the tournament is taking place on the 1st to the 6th of November. The participation, I guess the players got finalized during the course of this week. This is an interesting set of players. Mostly, how does the Czech Republic not win this tournament? is my question, just given the lineups of players there. When you lead with Krejcikova, Vondrousova, Martinikova, and Siniakova, I think you're probably going to win this tournament. I feel pretty strongly about that. Canada actually has a decent team as well. Leila Fernandez scheduled to play in that tournament along with Rebecca Marino. So fingers crossed we get a good showing from the Canadians. Moving on, aforementioned Dominic Thiem that we mentioned at the start of this podcast. Apparently he will not require surgery on the wrist. An incredibly, I don't know, bizarre back end of the year. Coaching changes. Blame social media back and forth over whether or not who's in a good place and who was responsible for Dominic Thiem's body. Apparently his wrist is holding up okay, but anytime the wrist is involved, I do feel a bit weird. You get Delpo feelings all over again, but apparently he doesn't require surgery, so we might see him in 2022.
Whenever I hear that, though, I think of when Novak didn't get surgery and then delayed it for no reason at all and then got it eventually and it turned out he needed it. I wonder when they say won't require surgery, it's like, really? The only thing that went well for Dominic, I feel like, was the Tennis TV stuff or the Tennis Channel stuff. Really good announcer. Thought he had good insight, but outside of that.
Bring him back and fire almost everyone else.
Yeah, well, almost everyone else. Nearly everyone else. Literally nearly everyone else. But Dommy.
Just Jimmy Arias. Just fire.
Yeah, Jimmy Arias and Dominic Thiem doing a lot of coverage, but I'm down. I'm down if we have to go that way. No, I'm worried. I'm legit worried, as you guys are too.
Yeah. I really think we need him back. I think it's not as extreme as what Rafa does, but I think one of his best attributes is he makes matches better. Like with the shots he hits and the way he fights, he makes his opponents play their best tennis, and that just creates a better spectacle. And so the rivalries that he was having with Djokovic and Medvedev and Rafa, they were amazing at the end of 2020. And at the end of that year, I would have said, like, he's the next guy. And now it looks like Medvedev is going to be the next guy, and I hope Thiem comes back and fights him for that.
Well, that's the sad part about the whole thing, because he was getting on top of them. Like, he had winning records against pretty much everyone. Like, it's sad.
That glorified exhibition, that Owen disparaged the World Tour Finals, my favorite event ever, that I shed many tears silently as Owen was ripping it earlier. I'm half joking, but that win there, his week there, that was the moment, right? That was the Dominic Thiem is here and he's going to shake it up.
I was more impressed with what he did there last year than what Medvedev did. And Medvedev won the tournament and beat him in the final. Like that, the way Thiem beat Nadal and Djokovic, like great matches, won all the big points. And he won them hitting these 100-mile-an-hour winners. Like the reason reason I trash one-handed backhands is because I'm like, you'll hit your 100-mile-an-hour winner, but you'll never do it when it matters. And Thiem does it when it matters. Like that is a very rare thing. And I miss that.
Come back, Thiem. We want you back. We do. We want you back for good.
You know you're listening to this.
Absolutely, yeah. So one of the surprising things in this, not surprising, but Naomi Osaka dropped out of the world's top 10. I suppose we were speaking last week about how Rafael Nadal made it 6,000 days or whatever it was inside of the world's top 10. Naomi Osaka drops out of it the very next week. Interesting parallels in terms of both of those players. I didn't realize she was that close to dropping out, but given how little she's played and the year that she's had, I guess it's not really that surprising. I think the only other point that I'd make on this is that I don't really know how the rankings work anymore, given what the ranking increase is like and where we are.
I have stopped trying to understand.
Maria Sakkari's in the top 10 for the first time, I think. That is also what happened. I think she was being one of those players who was held back unfairly by the crazy freeze. So that's a positive, even though she lost early in Indian Wells.
Okay, closing out, just a few quick ones. There was an interview conducted with young Italian Lorenzo Musetti, where he was talking about his private life. Very open and honest interview in Sportfare, the Italian outlet, talking about breaking up with his girlfriend, talking about some of the struggles he's had with his own mental health as well. Did not look right at all this week. And really a shadow of the player that I think we all saw during the course of the year. This one's kind of sad, and clearly we hope that things move in a better direction for him, because I have spoken at length on this podcast about how much I rate him. I have not seen a player strike more viciously a tennis ball and have such creativity in a long time on the tour. So fingers crossed he gets back to good health and finds himself in a good place.
100%. Well said. Rome feels like a long time ago, right? Like I feel like since that moment, or since maybe about the springtime, it's gone downhill, but hoping for the best for him. I had one more left. As we record the 1 year anniversary of Iga Świątek winning Roland Garros, we talked about it a bit in the last segment. At 19, she won without dropping a set, becoming the lowest ranked RG champion in open era history and Poland's first Grand Slam singles champion. It's interesting. I don't think Iga's in that conversation, or she doesn't get put in that conversation about one-hit wonders or not being able to follow it up, because I think she had a pretty good year to follow it up, but she hasn't reached those heights. She's been consistent. I wonder where you guys rate her right now. I know, Simon, you're still really high.
Absolutely. In terms of ball striking, in terms of just outright power and a brain on the tennis court, I still think she will be world number one at some point in her career. She's just too good for it not to happen.
Yeah, I would... I'm not sure about world number one, but I think it's inevitable that she at least wins Roland Garros again. And I've liked what she's done on hard courts this year as well. So I think definitely big things to come for her. She's still super young. So 1 year that you wouldn't even call a down year, but failed to live up to last year, I don't think is that consequential for her.
Bang. Anything left, Bush? I know you have the quote, a quote from the tennis journalist who shall not be named in the doc. I will let you explain what
I was going to take issue with who that quote was from.
Did this happen? Is this transcript accurate?
Yeah, that one is, we might want to check on it, of what actually happened. I just thought it was a really fun mix of Luigi Gatto asking a question to Stefanos Tsitsipas of, did you get vaccinated? Tsitsipas responding, I'm sorry, but I'm not able to provide any of my medical records or any of my medical status. Thank you. So I guess open question to the pair of you. Did any of this happen?
So I think I want to ask, like, did Luigi ask this question? Because I feel like he just tweets random stuff that he doesn't generate. I think he scours the web for these quotes and then posts them out of context. Like, I don't know. Maybe this means that Tsitsipas is vaccinated.
Exactly.
Maybe this is a quote from 2 years ago.
Repurposed.
It's the flu vaccine.
Yeah, talking about his measles shot 2005. Fantastic. Perfect end. Okay, we hit our final segment. Our segment within a segment. Two challenges remaining. Our pop culture references to close out. Simon, what do you got?
So I was flying on the plane from Vancouver to Montreal watching Squid Game with my partner, and we were like, okay, we're enjoying this a lot, but to give you an extent of how wide this thing is sort of spread in terms of popular culture, I went up to go to the bathroom a few times. It was just stretching my legs. I counted no fewer than about 15 people on the plane also watching Squid Game, which is nutso.
Was it available on the in-flight?
No.
Or?
Wow. No, people had just downloaded it on like iPads and laptops. I was just looking around like, well, that scene looks familiar. What are they watching? Oh, wait, they're also watching Squid Game. Insane. Absolutely insane.
What game did you think was the most tense in the series, Simon?
Has to be the marbles game. Surely has to be the marbles game. That thing was like genuinely quite sad. I don't want to go too spoilery, but
yeah,
one character in Squid Game
yet.
Seems incredibly naive. Is what I'll say in that marbles game.
That's a good way of putting it.
Mine is because Simon got me on season two hard, but I watched Lasso. I binged it. I watched the finale. A bit disappointed. No spoilers as well, but a bit disappointed by the last episode, Bush. I'm not quite sure what to do, and I'm left searching, but I had higher hopes.
What in particular was the thing that made you upset? Was it a certain sign? Let's not
it was, you know what? Yeah, I honestly, frankly, it was a lot of the sign. I had no spoilers again, but man, just shook. Owen, I don't want to take time away from your chat. What do you got?
No worries. So I guess one of my favorite TV shows for a long time has been Lucifer. It's on Netflix. They recently released the last season. I thought it was disappointing, but I would still recommend watching that if you need a new show. Very easy to binge.
Perfect. That's always a huge recommendation in these times, because if someone recommends a bad show to you and you watch it, you don't forget them.
Hang on a second.
I can kill my chances of coming on here ever again.
I'm joking.
Isn't that a perfect slogan for Netflix, though? The idea that, you know, a bit disappointing, but it's very easy to binge. Shouldn't that just be the tagline for it in general as a product?
I'm leaving a Squid Game because people are telling me it's good, so I have that in my back pocket if I need something to really get into. But we're in spoiler land enough where I probably have to get going on it, but I will watch it, I think.
I think you'll enjoy it. Overall, it is a show that obviously is saying a lot of things about different parts of society and economic structures and everything, and the fact that it's the story in the background from it, I think you would enjoy it. It is quite violent, though, so just go into
and
it.
And you know, I'm soft, as I well documented. I'm soft. Horror movies. We're in October month. This is a freaky month. I gotta be attentive at the ghouls and goblins, but I'll watch it. I'm okay with that.
I wasn't gonna say this, but I am also very soft with horror movies and stuff, and so I haven't. I've only watched the first episode of Squid Game because I couldn't take how intense it was. Yeah. But I just read stuff like articles and opinions, and this is something that my friends relentlessly make fun of me for, because if something is too scary and I find it interesting, I just read everything instead of watching. So
you are not. I just want you to know you are not alone. There are many of us out there.
So glad to know that.
We read the wikis when we can't take the pain.
Those Vulture episode recaps, those are clutch.
Amazing. Owen, amazing to have you. Love to have you back. Where can we find your stuff?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'll come back anytime. And I write for racketblog.com, and I'm a co-host of the Tennis and Bagels podcast. So you can find my stuff there, assuming you want to hear more of the dumpster fire of my takes.
We do, and big fan of Tennis and Bagels. In terms of tennis content, would recommend.
Really appreciate it.
Those cats. You guys make it fun, and also usually write about stuff, which I think is usually key when it comes to tennis analysis. Simon, anything else before we sign off?
Nothing from me.
Enjoy Montreal, friend, and safe travels back. A reminder, we are on patreon.com/openerapod. Simon, we have a new patron.
Yes, huge thanks to Ethan Lee for joining and We are always thankful for our patrons. Like, genuinely, we are. We're always amazed that people support us. And we still love doing the podcast. And your support is always greatly appreciated.
Be like Ethan. Join us on Patreon. You get access to the Discord. We're chatting tennis all the time. You get the show ad-free. Plus, you get it early on Sundays when we record. So it's a pretty good deal. We're also on Twitter, at OpenEraPod. So find us there. Tweeting all the time. And if you could, a rating or review wherever you get this podcast would be great for us. A massive thank you, as always, to Dylan on the ones and twos. And a big thanks to Owen for joining us, and Simon. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks, as always, for listening to Open Era.